Welcome to Catch a Mac Science. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Once a month on Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon, Catch a Mac Science will provide a platform for discussion, inquiry, and peer review of local science. On this episode of Catch a Mac Science, you're going to hear audio from last night's panel discussion held at the Lusac Library in Anchorage. The EAC Preservation Council and Inlet Keeper hosted a gathering for the purpose of observing the 30th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. For about the next 40 minutes, you'll hear comments and discussion from Pamela Miller, the founder and executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, Shauna Lawson, the regional director of Native Movement, Ine Begay-Peter, the executive director of Native Movement. Their mission statement says they exist to provide support for grassroots projects that endeavor to ensure Indigenous peoples' rights, the rights of Mother Earth, and the building of healthy, sustainable, self-determined communities for all. And the discussion starts out with Dune Lankyard, the founder of the EAC Preservation Council and commercial fisherman. He opened the discussion by talking about how he found out that the Exxon Valdez had run aground on Bly Reef in Prince William Sound, spilling over 30 million gallons of crude oil, covering 1,300 miles of coastline and 11,000 square miles of ocean.
Corporation just called us all together in the middle of the room and said that now that the nation's worst oil spill just happened in our backyard, let's clear cut the trees as fast as we possibly can. And Pamela said, so Dune, either come home and help us save our homeland or don't bother coming home because there's not going to be anything left. And so I realized at that moment that I had to become this social change activist. I had to figure out how I was going to stand up for the land and the people and the animals and our wildlife and our salmon and our culture. And so after the game, I took everybody out early. You know, I was like angry. And then we circled up and I said, we all have to go home. It's time to save our land. We've just had the nation's worst oil spill in our backyard. And then we had to take on Exxon, we had to take on the loggers, we had to take on the Native corporations, we had to take on all the powers that be. And we ended up saving 765,000 acres out of a million acres that was scheduled to be clear cut. But we had to do it by being louder than everything else and as strong as we possibly could. And even though we were upset, we had to remain this voice of reason so people would listen to us. And so we've been in existence now for 30 years. We've taken on 35 major environmental battles and won 33 of them. And we're about to save another 3 million acres of the Copper River Delta here soon. So I'm absolutely honored to be here with you all.
Good evening, everyone. It's just really good to be with all of you this evening as we remember the Exxon Valdez oil spill and really all that we're doing to make this world a better place and prevent that from ever happening again. My name is Pam Miller and I work with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And in 1988, I was working for the Coastal Zone Program at the Washington Department of Ecology and ran a very small marine environmental education center in Puget Sound. And there was a spill that was just a few months later greatly overshadowed by the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but the Nestucca spill was also a spill that coated the coast of Washington and part of Vancouver for hundreds of miles of the coast. And I was in charge of organizing the response and the cleanup and recovery of injured birds and mammals. And I remember at the time I went out to Willapa Bay in the southern part of Washington, and we were setting up a station there to recover the birds and try to rescue the animals that we could. And there was a man from BP in the next room, and I could hear him on the phone. And he said, "Well, you gotta crack a few eggs to make an omelet." And I thought at that time, and I'm a nonviolent person, that I might just resort to violence. But we spent weeks and months out there, and then the spill happened in Prince William Sound, the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And I was hired by Greenpeace, and at the time we were working to protect the coast of Washington and Oregon and Alaska from further offshore oil and gas development. And so I moved to Alaska to work for Greenpeace to prevent further offshore oil and gas development. And then eventually we brought a lawsuit against the oil companies in Cook Inlet for their thousands of violations of the Clean Water Act that then helped to found Cook Inlet Keeper. And then I founded Alaska Community Action on Toxics in 1997. And one of the things that we did following that was to document the many thousands of workers who became sick and died as a result of being in oil up to their eyeballs, literally day in and day out for 18 hours a day, exposed to benzene and other toxic chemicals, and we documented the injuries. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I thank you, and it's just really good to be here tonight.
And Saridat Chamakhet. I'm Shauna Larson. I'm Sukhbi on my mom's side from the village of Hollowick, also known as Port Graham. I'm Atna on my dad's side from the village of Naideniana, also known as Chickalin Village. I want to acknowledge the traditional people of the land that we're on, the Dena'ina people. This was a shared area by Iklutna Village as well as Tyonik. Chickalin Village is, we recognize Palmer as our traditional jurisdiction, and Wasilla is Kinnik's traditional jurisdiction. So I just want to honor the ancestors for the people whose land that we're on. I was 15 years old when the Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred. My mom was 37. My grandfather was in Port Graham, a commercial fisherman with all of his sons, and that's what they did. That was their livelihood, and my mom suited up. She got a job pretty quickly. She suited up and she went out onto the beach and she worked to clean. They worked, you know, from sunup to sundown to clean the oil off the beach. My mom is 68 this year, and she is in an assisted living home. She suffers from all types of different illnesses, and she's not actually able to speak anymore. And she's been in that assisted living home for the last 10 years. I'm 45 this year, and 2 years ago, I underwent a double mastectomy for breast cancer. And so I just really feel like a lot of the chemicals and things that we were exposed to are very much linked to the issues that we are faced with today. So I'm happy to be here and happy to be with such a great panel of experts.
Jeg er glad for at jeg har en navigator, der er til net, har jeg en nationale, der er højt i nævnes team, og der er også en nationale, og der er næsten nationale. Hi, my name is Ine Bigay Peter. I'm Navajo and Dana Octum, so southern Dene, way southern. I also just want to acknowledge the peoples, the indigenous peoples of this land, as well as the indigenous peoples of the land that I live on now, the Lower Tanana, Dene peoples, Athabascan peoples. I live in Fairbanks. And also recognize the peoples of my husband's people, their ancestry, the Kuchen people of Arctic Village, who have also caretaked
that land for generations and generations. I come to this work, let's see, I guess at the Exxon Valdez spill, I was a teenager living in Arizona. I had no idea, like a lot of people in the lower 48, and probably anything about Alaska, really. I grew up on the Navajo Reservation, and yet similar to what's happening up here, having no real understanding of this distant land, except as like kind of mythology, because in Navajo, actually, we have stories of the people from up here. Our people are connected. We talk about our relatives in the north, and it's old history, but we talk about our relatives in the north like it was some things that just happened recently, and that's why we're separated by such distance. But I was a teenager on the reservation, and similar to up here, our communities are very dependent on coal, fossil fuel extraction as a means of economic development. So I grew up in a community that was right between one of the largest strip mine operations in the country and a whole bunch of abandoned uranium mines. And the coal that was being extracted was being mixed with our sole source of drinking water and shipped to power plants to power the Los Angeles and Las Vegas. So very much this concept of, Winona LaDuke says this, when you live in an over-consuming society, it requires constant intervention into other people's territories. And it's indigenous people's territories that are constantly being taken from, right? Because 40% of the natural resources of this country are still under indigenous communities. What little we have left of our traditional territories, right? 40% of those natural resources are under that in this country. And so we're still in these battles, these Indian wars for our lands and resources are still being waged today, right? And so I went to school to study a bunch of this, right? Because I was like, how could we have gotten to this place where we're in such a position of having to divorce ourselves from our values and our traditional ancestral knowledge of caretaking for the earth in order to like cannibalize her, in order to have a job and put food on the table. How could we have gotten to this place? Well, it's a long history of colonization, right? But I studied geological and environmental science and I went home and started an organization in my home community to do grassroots organizing, to build that people power, to advocate for change. And along the way, I met this young man from Alaska and fell in love, and somehow I find myself up here years ago. So I've been up here now since 2003, so not too long, but we have three young daughters who are of all span the Athabascan-ness. Athabascans go from, you know, the northern part of Alaska all the way down to southern Arizona. And I'll say, you know, when I first brought my husband back to my community, my aunts just got mad at me. They said, "What are you doing? You're bringing about the end of the world." Because we have this prophecy that when the northern Athabascan and the southern Athabascan meet again, it will be the end of the world. And my grandfather, who just only speaks Navajo, he said, "Oh," he pulls me aside, he in Navajo, and he just said, "Don't." That's just how they misinterpreted it, right? It's not the end of the world. It's a transition that feels like the end of the world, right? But of course, I said, "There's other Navajos already up there. It's not my fault." So we're in this time of transition, and I think that's inevitable, right? Where the only thing constant is change, and for those of us who are not understanding that transition is inevitable, we're keeping ourselves blind, right? We cannot continue the path that we have been going on. That's just unsustainable. And so the work that we do at Native Movement, I'm now the executive director of an organization that's based here in Alaska called Native Movement. The work that we do there is really about, yes, understanding that transition is inevitable, but justice is not. And if we are not part of demanding justice, then the transition might continue down an further exploitive and oppressive path. And so we are really focused on building people power, being bold, and advocating for a just transition. And I'll probably talk about that later. But I'm just really, really honored and thankful to have been asked to come to this panel and to be sitting with these amazing people who have been doing this work in Alaska for so long, who even before I moved up here, I heard their voices from the South and heard the power of their words from the North, coming to the lower 48, to the South, echoing of the justice that needs to be had. So, kehe.
So, I don't know if anyone caught Rick Steiner on Alaska Public Radio in the last couple of days. I'll channel him right now. Rick was one of the 3-4 activists in our community. There was Rick Steiner, Ricky Yacht, who you saw in the film, David Grimes, and myself. We were like the four musketeers. And then later on, a few years later, after this bill, Carol Hoover started working with our EAC Preservation Council. And but we were pretty tight. We worked together pretty solid for about 15 years in a row. Exxon appealed the $5 billion verdict 17 times until they got the Supremes that they wanted. And those Supremes didn't take the case to see that justice was served. They took the case to see that just us was served. And so they reduced that punitive damage settlement from a 17-1 payout at the $5 billion to $500 million, which was equivalent to one good day of fishing for the 30,000 plaintiffs in the spill zone. And over 6,000 of the original plaintiffs died before they ever received a settlement. But Rick said, we would have received a fairer, better, faster settlement from Judge Judy than we received from the federal courts. And he said that we learned that restoration can't restore the environment. And the oil spills, once they hit the water or the land, they can never be cleaned up. And areas where oil spills happen will forever be changed. So if you think that one day it'll restore or recover, it won't. I mean, we're living proof of what can go wrong. And like the people who live in the Arctic Refuge in that region, if any oil from their region goes into that pipeline, it's going to end up in Prince William Sound. It'll end up in our home. And when you think about the 27 most heavily impacted species that are still recovering from the Exxon Valdez oil spill, 12 of them are still recovering. They haven't fully recovered. 4 of them will not recover. The orcas, there was 36 resident orcas that lived in Prince William Sound, made their living there, and they were gasping the oil from the surface because they come up for air often, and they were drinking all of that oil. And so now out of those 37 original orcas, there's only 7 left. And they only mate once. They never, if their mate passes away, they don't, you know, find a new mate. So it's just a matter of time. Their days are numbered. The herring, as you saw, have not recovered. We've only fished 2 or 3 years out of the last 30 years, which used to be half of our income. And so, you know, our goal was to, me as a fisherman, I'd try and put $50,000 in my pocket before I caught my first salmon. And that was from the herring alone. And like Ricky said in the film, if the herring recover, the people recover, but so will the sound. The other couple of species is the marbled merlets and the pigeon guillemots. These are just beautiful birds that lived in the sound that they will never see again. And even to this day, there's areas that are really silent. Like Ronnie Anderson, the elder native there, was speaking. He passed away not too long ago. There's silent places in Prince William Sound that always used to be vibrant and alive. Every April, every species would come to life, and all the herring would feed them all. And that no longer happens. And so what was sacred and our way of life and where we grew up from the time we were 5, 6, 7 years old, and we would go fishing with our family for 3 months out of the year on the Sound, those days are no longer. It's turned into a whole different fishery, and it's all based on hatchery fish, no more wild one. Like back then in 88, Cordova for 10, 15 years was one of the top seafood ports in poundage harvest and dollars made in America. It took us 25 years to get back on that list, but we're not on there because of the wild fish have recovered. We're on there because the hatchery fish have outnumbered and replaced the wild fish.
The oil corporations and the fact that they are really the petrochemical industry. And Shauna was talking about the health effects and how chemicals have affected her. And really all of us are contaminated with hundreds of chemicals without our consent. And this is a basic human rights issue. And the very same companies, Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, on and on, Dow, DuPont, these are petrochemical corporations that use the basic structure of the hydrocarbon molecule to make industrial chemicals and pesticides and plastics. And these are now contaminating the planet, the Arctic, the farthest reaches of the world, and all of us. And so we have to stop this madness. And my work is focused on chemicals and stopping the production and release of these chemicals. But the fundamental issue is to stop oil and gas production, because this is what fuels plastics and industrial chemicals and pesticides that are contaminating this planet. In 2015, ExxonMobil earned a quarter of its net profits from its chemicals division. They're the world's largest producer of phthalates, which are softening agents in plastics, which cause reproductive health problems, especially in young boys. In the decades to come, if trends continue, the consumption of oil by the plastics sector will account for about 20% of the total consumption of oil. So we have to stop this madness and transition justly to a new way of living, relying on renewable energy and alternatives that are safe for the planet and safe for our health.
I now serve as the Regional Director for Native Movement, and I also serve on my traditional tribal council for Chicklin Village, as well as serve as a tribal court judge. And I feel like my relationship with my grandfather and all my uncles and my aunties, my mom, I was the year before when I was 14 years old that I worked for the first time, I had a job. I was hired in Port Graham in the cannery, and I worked on the slime line and in the egg house, which I thought was really great, but apparently it was like on the lower side of the totem pole of the jobs. I earned a lot of money. I earned $2,000 that summer, all of which I spent at the store, and my dad was completely shocked that I came home with $0 in my pocket. A lot of candy, some nice sweatshirts, some tapes. We listened to tapes back then. It's taken me a long time over the years of colonization to kind of figure out our traditional connection with the land and what that means. And it's only been through a series of events that have happened to me over the last 10 or 15 years that helped me reflect back to my childhood, to help me understand a better way to articulate our indigenous connection to the land. And I think, you know, we hear a lot about corporations and we hear a lot about the technical terms, and you also hear things like sacred and way of life, subsistence, tradition. Sometimes you even hear inextricably linked. When I was small, I lived in Port Graham. We were there for the summer. My mom and dad were fishing, and we were staying in a small tent. And my dad would take me to the library, and we would check out books. And there were very limited book selection, which he would get tired of reading over and over and over. And so he started telling me hunting stories. And I didn't realize it at that point, but these stories are the way that we have kept our tradition alive for many, many years. And that's how we've passed on our knowledge. There was no formal schools or college or PhD. We taught our future generations through stories. And I was at a council meeting about 9 years ago, and maybe 8 years ago, and our elder asked us if I could help come up with a different word for the term subsistence. He said, "Have you ever looked that word up in the dictionary, Shauna?" He said, "Just look it up." And so I looked it up, and what it really means is to merely survive. And we would never describe our culture in that way. We're not just merely surviving. We are strong, indigenous, thriving. So he said, "I don't like all these federal documents and how they are using that term, and I want to find a different word to use." I said, "Okay." And I thought, "Oh, I'll Google it, you know, this shouldn't be too hard." Well, I wasn't able to find anything on Google. I thought there must have been some other tribes who had done this before. I couldn't find anything, and I asked two of the elders in our community, and they said, they said the same thing, but at different times and apart from one another. They both told me in our language, they said, when the fish are ready, when it's time to hunt, or when the berries are ripe. They said these very specific phrases. And that wasn't really what I was looking for. And it wasn't until a few months later I ran into an elder from Bobby Anderson, who since passed, the late Bobby Anderson, who spoke Yupik. And I thought, well, maybe in Yupik they have a different way to say it. So I asked him, and he was my friend. We'd done work together, traveled around together. And he said the exact same thing my elder said. He told me in Yupik, when the berries are ready, when it's time to hunt, when it's time to fish. And I said, no, that's not what I mean. And he kind of laughed at me. He said, "What do you mean?" And I held out my hand and I said, "If this was the land and the animals, and this is the people, how do you say this?" And he said, oh. He said, "There is no way to say that. There's no one word for that." He said, "What you're describing is a story, because stories make you feel. And feeling is the only way to understand your true relationship and responsibility to the land and the animals." And so I feel like we really have to think about these stories and our traditions. And I never could really think of how to explain. I worked for Alaska Community Action on Toxics for 9 years. Very proud to have worked there with Pam. She practically raised me. Lucky to work with Ine at Native Movement. And for all those years that I did that work when I was younger, I had such a difficult time trying to explain, in particular to a lot of the other environmental organizations, about our relationship to the land and to the animals. And recently, I moved back home. I took a break. I was burned out from all of this. And I lived down in Tucson for 6.5 years. My husband's from Tucson. And I moved back, and I was at a hearing on Arctic Refuge. And one of the elders stood up, and he spoke about the Porcupine caribou herd, and he talked about how they had stories in their language that said that one of the tribal members became a porcupine caribou and decided to stay that way, but asked the people to please make an agreement that they would for the porcupine caribou herd. And that was the compact or the agreement that was made. We also have those traditional stories in our language, and I didn't really put that together until just a few months ago. We have the Ndosi story, which is the ant people, the ant woman story, and it's very similar. And I recently saw the whale song, a play that was put on by a dear friend of mine, Kathy Rexford, and it talks about how one indigenous individual becomes a whale, and how the people make a compact with the whale nation. And then it wasn't just until last week I went to Ton Othum lands, and they told us, they took us to their sacred mountain, and they told us their creation story. And the story was about how when they were created, they made an agreement with the Creator that it would be their job to take care of the land in return for being able to live in an indigenous way and have that connection with the land and animals. And so I just like to try to share those stories to help articulate this understanding as it's come to me, to help explain what our real connection is to the land and to the animals, and what happens when something so devastating, this kind of an atrocity, happens. What happens when we've made an agreement with the fish and a traditional fish are gone? What does that do to our culture?
I'm gonna just talk a bit about, I think, just transition and what that means. I think, you know, I didn't grow up in Alaska, but I know a lot of this same struggle of this kind of economic hostage situation that we're in, that we find ourselves in, because my community, like I mentioned earlier, totally dependent on fossil fuel extraction. The coal company that provided the jobs to my people, they were the largest employer on the Navajo Reservation, and they provided 290 jobs. Our population is a 250,000. And that was the largest employer, so we have pretty big unemployment. And so to threaten or to, you know, counter any of the environmental degradations or the spiritual cultural degradations or the water degradations that this company was doing, you know, was threatening people's jobs and you know, being able to put food on the table for particularly the communities that I grew up in. So how then do we try to get out of this kind of economic hostage situation? How do we say no to the poisons and start to transition our economy and not just leave our communities without any way of surviving? Because unfortunately, because of that history of colonization, you know, so much of our lands and our way of self-determination and self-sustaining were now taken away, right? So we're dependent in so many ways on this economy. One of the solutions that we found was in looking at communities from frontline communities in California, who are people of color communities who are workers in the power plants and the refineries, and who also lived right next to the refineries. And so they're both getting the pollutants and also dependent for those jobs. And what communities in Southern California did was this just transition strategy of, well, we know we can't stop this instantly, But we know we cannot continue this path. So how do we transition? We have to bring in the labor unions. We have to start bringing in, it can't be the Sierra Clubs or the NRDCs or these big environmental groups. It has to come from our communities being empowered to say no and pointing the direction that we want to go, right? And so communities coming together with environmental organizations, coming together with labor unions, coming together with the nurses of the community, you know, mothers, fathers, finding common ground in how do we begin phasing out these extractive industries and retrain workers? How do we put together retraining programs within our educational institutions? How do we get workers who are going to be phased out benefits? This is what these communities were doing. It's pretty amazing work in the mid-90s, early 90s. In Navajo, we said, okay, you know, we have the opportunity to do something like this as well, but we also have a special ability to kind of really think outside of the box because we don't have another economy already in place at all. What we do have is our traditional economy, right? And our traditional economy, we have to think, it's an economy is not just income, GDP, right? This is what we've all been told is economy. And yet, when you look at that word of economy and you break it down, I think it's Greek. Eco actually means home. And so economy really means the management of home. And when we manage our home, it's not necessarily about what our GDP is and it is about what we're bringing in, how we're taking care of our family, how we're managing our home. And so we look at our traditional economy and how we manage our home in that way, but also recognize that we're not necessarily going back, right? How do we take the benefits and of modern marketing structures and pair that with our traditional economies to come up with something that works for our community? That's not just transitioning us from the coal or the oil and gas powered battery to the country to a renewable battery, but how are we really envisioning and thinking larger than we've been taught to think? And what we came up with was we realized that so much of our community members still herded sheep, and they shear sheep every summer, and yet so much of this country imports wool from New Zealand for carpet and wool products. We thought, wow, if we can bridge local Navajo produced wool with some of the Peace Fleece and Green Eco Carpet companies, we could have a market for that. We could make it sustainable, make it green, make it fair trade. So we did workshops within our community to bring up the value of the wool, because Navajo community members would take their wool and go to the border towns, and you couldn't get enough money just for the gas it costs to drive to the border town for a truck bed full of wool. So we decided to cut out the border town middleman, found the eco carpet companies, found these other wool companies, did these value-added workshops with our community to get that wool to a certain level. And in the first year we did a wool buy, and this is with community members putting this together, the first community filled a semi-truck full of wool that went to U.S. wool buyers. And the money went directly to those community members, like over, you know, way more than they had been making previous. Last year was the fifth year, and it was in five different communities and filled five semis, all for wool production, going to wool buyers here in this country. And so the work that those communities are doing has really taken off and providing for the families, maybe not full year round, but it's providing for those families, right? So that's just some idea that community that I'm proud to have been a part of in that community But really trying to think, it really took us thinking outside of what we've been taught to think. And so, you know, here in Alaska, we've been supporting communities on the North Slope, and I understand the hard place it is for communities who, particularly in those areas surrounded by oil and gas development, to speak out, to even propose a different economy is dangerous in some ways, right? It's like threatening to their family members, to them. And yet, that's what community members are doing across Alaska. And I think it's up to all of us, you know, whether we're in those communities that are directly impacted or not, it's up to each of us to have their back, to stand up boldly and demand of our elected leadership, of our state government, that we cannot continue to have an economy based on taking out of resources from these communities and exploiting and polluting communities across the state. It's up to each of us to stand up and ask for a new, a just transition to a post-oil economy.
I love this panel about what you said about subsistence. When all the lawyers came to Prince William Sound and they were trying to figure out what animals got hurt, which ones did we subsist off, and how were they going to value our losses, you know, we said, well, there's intrinsic valuations that are absolutely priceless. Our animals, our subsistence is actually an act of philanthropy. So when we share our food, like if I catch some fish and I give it to your family and your family and your family and my family and they give it to their friends, then you're actually sharing that food that they wouldn't have to go to the store and purchase. And so subsistence, we never got near the money that the commercial fishermen received for their losses. But I found it really interesting that we had to grapple with what our subsistence way of life was really worth. And, you know, even to this day, subsistence and living from the land and the ocean is comparable to none. And so when I think about, you know, what has happened, you know, from the time of the oil spill, yeah, I can still be really angry and I can fight with the best of them. I've been with this crew, I've been in probably 50 lawsuits and we've won 90% of them or more. And so I don't think that that's going to stop anytime soon, because we have to continue to fight for what we believe in and fight for our way of life that we want to pass on to our children. Because what are we leaving them? You know, like, what are we leaving little Ananda? We want to leave them with a sporting chance and an opportunity to at least live some sort of life that isn't just about restoration and protecting what they have and all the bad decision debt that we're leaving them with. I feel that we have to do more. So like Anae was saying, we have to be bolder and louder than everything else. We have to be wise. We have to, you know, teach our children that there's a different way to live on the planet. And this is the only one that we have right now that we still all call home, and I don't think we're going to get to Mars fast enough. When I think about the real economic losses from climate change, or even the true social justice implications felt not only in the spill zone, but in other areas, a good example that's happening in America right now are the farmers. You know, the farmers got hit really hard with the tariffs, and now they're all getting flooded out. So 2 years in a row, they're taking a hit. Well, a lot of these farmers aren't going to be able to make it. There's a lot of bankruptcies going on. So what's happening is a lot of people who didn't believe that climate change was real, and they're waking up. And I'm just hoping that it's not too late. You know, I'm hoping that you know, we're gonna all figure out how to work together and address some of these issues that are going on, and figure out a way to curb those fossil fuels from going up into our atmosphere. And like Anae was saying, you know, we have to figure out how to diversify our economies so they make sense for our communities and they make sense for the environment, they make sense for our people. like in the spill zone communities, you know, I think if we're all growing kelp, you know, having growing kelp farms, that kelp would absorb all of the carbon and the nitrogen in the water and turn into oxygen and help the sound recover. All of the herring, the reason they haven't recovered is because they're all being spawned in the intertidal zone where there's still oil seepage that is impacting their survival rates. So if we are growing kelp in ponds off of the bottom in areas where there was a lot of fresh water, and we're sanding up the herring and putting them in there to spawn on that kelp, their chances of survival would be much greater. If everyone was growing kelp, they would clean up these intertidal zones in the spill zone. And there's all these tofu people who would love to have seaweed and buy all that kelp from us. So we wouldn't be able to produce it fast enough. And that means we'd be cleaning up the environment faster and having a good time out there again on Prince William Sound. A couple of things, and we'll go one more round here in our closing. But, you know, I think that if people realize that subsistence is culturally important, it's nutritionally important, economically, politically, it's how we survive. It's how we're gonna thrive and make it another 10,000 years or more, is if we can restore and preserve those foods and start growing them and taking care of our people. I remember when I first became an activist and I'd come home and I'd sit down with my sister Pamela and I wanted to just tell her everything that I learned and everything that I saw. And I said, Pamela, they're growing plants and food on the top of buildings in New York. I mean, like, you're not gonna believe this. And she'd hand me a fish and she'd say, go fillet this and then talk to me afterwards. And I'm like, she doesn't wanna know anything. And then I'd start filleting this fish and I would remember why I left the community to go out there and enlighten people to what was happening in my backyard. And so I realized that, you know, she had her way that she could absorb that information. And then I realized that I was that warrior that I was supposed to be. And I would go out there and I would learn these lessons and I'd bring things back home. And it helped us figure out how to stop the logging. It helped us figure out how to preserve our way of life. But now we gotta go one step further. We really have to figure out how to transition off of big oil. We really have to figure out how to protect the fossil fuels that are still in the ground. One of the campaigns that our EEC Preservation Council has been working on for 21 years is to preserve this Bering River coal field on the Eastern Copper River Delta, about 55 miles east of Cordova. And we've, in 2 years ago, in December of 2016, we preserved 85% of the Bering River coal field, where our regional corporation, Chugash, finally did the right thing and helped us protect that habitat. And the last 11,000 acres that is owned by the South Koreans, we're gonna make an offer on that coal field sometime this year. And once we buy that 11,000 acres, we'll stop the 55-mile road from being built across the Copper River Delta, and we'll save essentially all 3 million acres of lower Copper River watershed habitat for all time. So even though the salmon did not return last year, they'll have a home to come back to when they do find their way home. Since the spill, the only two really good things that have happened are there are double hull tankers, about 7,500 of them around the planet right now. That's a good thing. The other is that we have RCACs, Regional Citizens Advisory Council in the Sound and in Homer. But what we really need is double hull tankers, to replace all of the old fleet. And we need RCACs where government and industry basically pays us to watchdog them. This is the only way that we're gonna have oversight and be able to protect our waters and our resources. And a good example is in OPA 90, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, there was a oil spill liability trust fund established from 9 cents of per barrel of oil from the flow of oil from 77 to the present. And that means there's $6.5 billion in that fund that we can create these RCACs anywhere on the planet. It's just not for Alaska, but for other communities where oil travels through their regions. The other thing I'd like to see is 7 restoration funds established around the world with a minimum of $1 billion in each one of those funds, so we can help restore all of the places that industry and government have destroyed. And even having $1 billion, I mean, here we are 30 years later after the restoration settlement that Exxon paid, the $900 million out-of-court settlement, there's still $200 million left to do the right thing. We don't want to see endowments and salaries just covered for the rest of time. We'd really like to take that $500 million in science that shows that oil and water don't mix and dust that science off and put it to work in the communities, restore the spill zone.
That's Dune Lanker, the founder of the EAC Preservation Council and commercial fisherman, last night at the Lusac Library in Anchorage. Also on the panel, Ine Begay-Peter, the executive director of Native Movement, Shauna Larson, the regional director of Native Movement, and Pamela Miller, the founder and executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics. The panel was convened to commemorate tomorrow's 30th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill on March 24th of 1989. In Homer this weekend, there are a couple more events. The Alaskans Still Fighting exhibition by artist Mavis Muller is at K-Bay Cafe with an opening reception today from 3 to 6. Her Spillabilia will be at the cafe through March 31st. And tomorrow, Sunday, from 1 to 3 p.m., Inlet Keeper is hosting Stories and Remembrances and an open mic at the Boathouse Pavilion on the Homer Spit. Everyone is invited to share stories from the spill and the cleanup, or just to come and listen and have some chatter. Thanks for listening. Catch-a-Mac Science will be back in 4 weeks with more discussions, presentations, and reviews in the lab, in the classroom, and in the field. We share the data from local science by local scientists.